Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Most of us are spending more time at home than usual right now. And with restaurant dining rooms closed and additional restrictions now being placed on grocery stores, some people are taking to making some staples from scratch. Bread, of course, is a favorite. According to Google Analytics, searches for sourdough and related recipes were at least 5 times higher in the last month than ever before. Milwaukee's Central and Eastern European roots make it a big bread town, so it wasn't hard to find an expert baker, with, of course, the help of a Milwaukee Foodies Facebook group for a bunch of great tips. Lake Effect's Julian Haida recently spoke with chef, baker, and educator Michael Solovey.
Thanks so much for joining us on Lake Effect.
It's my pleasure.
What are, first things first, in your experience as an educator, some of the rookie mistakes when making bread?
Contamination is a pretty big problem. We've got to remember that baking is a cross between chemistry and physics, as opposed to just being, you know, really chemistry like most people think. So our kitchens are essentially laboratories, and they need to be kept clean. And our experiments, which is basically any time that we bake or cook, need to be kept clean as well. We need to stick to the rules.
So by contamination, you mean things getting into the bread or the dough that shouldn't be in there. That throws off the chemistry of the bread making process?
Correct. When you're cooking savory foods, chefs are more or less trained to make things work regardless of what circumstance brings us. But in baking, with chemistry being so important, that if the chemical equations get off and some of the physical properties that react to the chemical reactions that we're dealing with get off, then the whole thing can go haywire. And the biggest problem in this is that we lose track of exactly what might have gone wrong. And if you're not really big into chemistry, sometimes it's hard to analyze that and see it as a learning experience.
Some people use yeast for bread, and other people use something called a starter. What is a starter, and where can I get one?
Technically, in both of these situations, you're using yeast. It's a matter of whether or not you are purchasing yeast in a store and adding that to your other ingredients, or if you are harvesting your own yeast that exists naturally in the ingredients that we buy, such as flour, bread flour, and all-purpose flour. A starter is a pre-ferment. People call them different things, and there are different types of them. For instance, a poolish, which is sort of like the standard quote-unquote starter or pre-ferment for sourdough, the average sourdough bread. It comes from Polish bakers working in Vienna, and that pronunciation of Polish, Polish, sort of made its way into modern baking vernacular. And what you would basically be doing in a situation like in an old school bakery, you would be harvesting natural yeast from the flour that you're using just simply by adding warm water to it. Yeast eats, it's a single cell microorganism in the fungus family, and it eats sugar. And when it eats sugar, it gets a little bit gassy, and it produces carbon dioxide, and it also produces trace amounts of alcohol. So when you take a packet of yeast, such as, you know, Red Star yeast, and add that to your flour with, you know, salt and maybe olive oil or water or whatever ingredients might be in there, it wakes up first from a sort of a little nap, and then it gets to work. And the first thing it does is it starts eating any available simple sugars, and in doing so produces that carbon dioxide that we're looking for. And then when the dough goes through multiple stages of proofing and resting, and then, you know, your final rise, and including the process of baking itself, that gas, just like any gas when it is heated, is going to expand. And that's what gives us our leavening.
And leavening, that is the difference between a flatbread and a nice, soft, puffy bread that you might get, you know, wrapped up in kind of a nice, you know, paper bag, as opposed to kind of in the tortilla or pita section.
Correct. Well, I mean, even certain flatbreads by definition can be leavened. A lot of them are a quick leavened bread, which means that it doesn't have much time for too much carbon dioxide to develop. And you're not really developing a lot of gluten in the process too, which is something worth talking about as well. But those are similar, tantamount to like a pizza dough. what you said literally makes sense, that when you have a flat bread that's sort of like deflated and doesn't rise much, that is usually the absence of carbon dioxide, whether it be from anything from your yeast being too old, to maybe if you did make a starter in a pre-ferment, it didn't go for as long, or if you were proofing it, which is sort of like the last minute production of carbon dioxide in the dough, which is actually where the highest concentration of carbon dioxide is produced in the entire process. If you don't give it enough time, then there isn't enough carbon dioxide inside to rise to give the bread that volume that you're really looking for. But it's important to note, and this is a very common beginner mistake, that if you overproof your dough, if you take too much time, if you get a phone call and you get distracted and you let your dough develop too much in that final stage before you pop it inside of the oven, your gluten can relax a little bit too much and you might have produced too much carbon dioxide, which then causes the little bubbles inside of the dough that contain the carbon dioxide to burst, release that gas, and then same thing that you were talking about before, your dough gets sort of flat and deflated, never gets that volume that you're looking for.
And then it gets kind of dense, correct? I mean, you don't have the big, nice bubbles that you get in like a French bread or an Italian bread.
Absolutely. That's correct.
So we talked a little bit about the kind of dry yeast that you might get from the store. And we talked a little bit about this pre-ferment, this starter, this kind of goopy stuff that people keep in Ziploc bags and jars. Tell me more about that. I mean, I understand some people almost treat their starters like pets. What is so special about this starter that people often share with each other and then need to feed?
Sure. I love that analogy and drawing that parallel between a pet and a starter. And I believe that's true. You have to love your starter, which I think is a great idea, you know, when you have a pet. Making sure that it's brought up correctly in the proper manner, making sure that it has everything that it needs to grow up big and strong, and that it...
Because it is living. It's a living thing. I mean, it's kind of hard to imagine, but it almost breathes, grows, and makes some funny smells.
Yeah, this is exactly true. It's a culture, and this is where you get into, old... They'll oftentimes call them a sponge, pre-ferments or starters that come from the old world. Like, for instance, San Francisco is, you know, seen the world over as a great place to get awesome sourdough bread. And part of the reason that is true is, you know, that you have a lot of these old world starters, in some cases 150 years old, something that's been brought over from the old world, wherever that may be, usually somewhere in Europe. I've used starters from Eastern Europe before because I had an Eastern European restaurant that I was that I owned and ran for a little while. But the other thing about San Francisco, for instance, is that you have just this natural yeast. The Bay Area itself is alive with different cultures and a lot of different cultures of natural yeast. And when the seafoam accumulates in the bay and it dries up, it desiccates and it starts to break down into tiny little flakes. Those flakes go floating through the air. And then you have what we call ambient yeast. So when you live in an area that has a lot of ambient yeast, you know, the city of Milwaukee, for instance, has a decent amount just because of the amount of breweries that we have working around town.
And these are yeast particles just kind of floating in the air, in our atmosphere, on our clothes, just around us everywhere.
Correct. So now you can start to see the full scale of how important that idea of contamination is to the entire project. Because there's not only yeast, but there's a host of bacteria that compete with the yeast for its food floating around as well. And if you go stirring something with a dirty spoon or spatula, you can contaminate and basically kill your culture of yeast, because the yeast is not just living. The culture inside of the pre-ferment is not just living, but it is a miniature society of different bacteria and yeast. The word SCOBY used in making kombucha is SCOBY. It stands, the words are a symbiotic culture of bacteria and yeast. They have to play well together. There has to be some governance, and that's, you know, where we sort of step in and make sure that everybody's playing well together. But it's sort of our job to make everybody happy. And so, you know, just like your pets, if they're going to get along well together, they better not be fighting over their food.
Very interesting. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Lake Effect on WUWM 89.7, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Julian Haida, and I'm talking with Michael Solovey. He's a professional chef, baker, and educator here in Milwaukee. So where do people get these kinds of starters? You say, you know, some go back hundreds of years, and the ones that are used on the West Coast in the Bay Area. You said you've baked with starters, but you can't go to the supermarket and say, I want me a starter. They'll just sell you some dry yeast, maybe, and there are shortages of those now.
Yep.
How do you do that? Is it just who you know? Is it a back alley kind of thing?
No, it's not like truffles from Italy or something like that. You can find them pretty easily over the internet, and it just sort of depends on exactly what you're trying to achieve. As a starter continues, and I mean, even after 150 years, it's still slowly developing character. So certain flavor profiles can be expressed through using unique starters, but I'm a firm believer, and if you're going to take this entire process seriously, it's best just to do it yourself. When it comes to, you know, teaching classes, I always try to give people a better understanding of why we're doing what we're doing, instead of just saying, you know, here's a recipe, now cook. So my personal opinion is just starting out with the simple ingredients of equal parts flour and sugar, usually about 500 grams of each. That water has to be warm, but not too warm, which I usually recommend between about 105 to about 115 degrees, because yeast starts to die at about 117 to 120 degrees Fahrenheit.
And that's like a warm, like when you turn on your tap, like hot with a little bit of cold. Like it's kind of like warm to the touch, but not scalding.
Right. Think about like a hot tub. Some people like theirs, you know, pretty darn hot. Some people like it, you know, a little bit more on the warm side. Just as long as it's comfortable, it can sort of get to work. And if you continue to feed it on a daily basis, you will start to, you know, reactivate this society, this little culture of yeast. And cause them to eat the local sugars and produce that carbon dioxide. Now, if you do this without any added yeast from the store, it can take you a good month plus to get your starter to the point where it's bubbling. You can see that it's alive on a daily basis. And then it's consistent from one day to the next. It's not a little bit too dry. It's not a little bit too moist, but the same every time that you get back to it. And then, yes, you would basically just add a little bit of that to your other ingredients.
I used to bake a little bit, and I've picked it up again now that I'm at home like a lot of people. And I think I've nailed the classic round loaf out of a starter that I have. I'm a little too afraid to venture outside of the classic round loaf, but what are some of the things that you could do with that yeasty flour-water combination that's living on my shelf?
Well, you can use it for a few different things. For instance, like when I make a pizza dough, which I will oftentimes use if I have a nice starter going on, which I usually do, I will usually add that to my pizza dough and give it a couple of days. Again, you've got, you know, two things that you're trying to achieve here. You're trying to develop flavor and you're trying to develop texture. And it's important to know why the texture is the way that it is. So, I mean, first of all, you know, you ask me, what else can you do? My goodness, my brain starts swimming because there's so many possibilities that I don't even know which ones to start with. Anything that you want a real crust to, anything that you want real flavor in, you can add these starters to them.
What are some of the advantages of baking at home as opposed to going out and getting yourself a loaf of bread, whether it be from the supermarket, wrapped in plastic, or from your local baker?
Number one, it's good for the soul. Doing things yourself, warming your kitchen, warming the hearth of your home, and creating those wonderful smells. There is really nothing like it. Aside from that, when you buy a soft loaf of bread from a grocery store, it is more often than not going to have way more sugar than is necessary. So, that simple fact alone that we really shouldn't be eating more sugar than is necessary in our diets, because if we overload the liver with more sugar than it can produce, it calls upon the pancreas to excrete insulin and then stores that sugar as fat in our bodies. But then, you know, all the other things that sugar can do, the way that sugar basically feeds cancer cells, it's something we want to avoid if we can. So if we're trying to eat healthy, it's very important, but also the benefits and the quality of your food and the fact that we're going to be expanding our palates, not just flavor-wise, but texturally speaking, and certainly with the appearance, there are so many benefits. It's tough for me to bottle them into one conversation.
I can tell, and we're out of time, but Michael Solovey, thanks so much for joining us on Link Effect.
Julian, thank you. Have a great day.
Michael Solovey is a chef, a former restaurateur, and now educator. He's taught more than 1,500 hours of cooking classes, especially on the chemistry of baking. He spoke with Link Effect's Julian Haida.